You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is Renee Gerlich. She has written a wonderful book, which she sent me, and I have just completed. It's called Out of the Fog, on Politics, Feminism, and Coming Alive. Good morning, Renee. How are you?
Good. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
This book is fantastic. I finished it over the weekend. It is put out by Spinifex Press, which I have Professor Sheila Jeffries. I know she has stuff there, and Rose Hunter. I've also spoken to her. They're wonderful. They're a brilliant publisher and have got some great titles. And this book covers so many elements. On the back here, you've got from radicalized police brutality to climate change, Me Too, trans rights, COVID-19, the prospect of nuclear war, and the prevalence of trauma. We're constantly bombarded with high stakes problems that we're expected to speak out and act upon. On closer inspection, the popular solutions to these problems aren't easy to reconcile. And it goes on from there. You cut through the fog, but for our listeners to begin with, tell us a little bit about you. Who is Renee?
Good question. Well, I grew up on the Kapiti Coast. My parents immigrated. So sometimes I feel as if I grew up in a state of culture shock that I never quite grew out of. So I've always been wandering around with this question of, like, who are these people? What are they about? And one thing I speak about in my book too is that a huge component of that is I remember at a very young age, so I was born in the 80s, and I remember at a very young age seeing what was like a television meme of the 80s and 90s, the image of an emaciated child, normally an African child. So I grew up during the Ethiopian famines, and I just remember how shocked I was at seeing this image on the nighttime news of this starving child, and assuming that this was an emergency that was going to be remedied immediately now that the world was aware of it. And it just wasn't. These images just persisted and persisted and persisted, and I became increasingly aware that I'm growing up in a world where there is child starvation, there is war, and these things aren't ending. In other words, I'm going to inherit these problems as an adult, but we don't talk about them at school. That never made sense to me. So I was constantly asking myself, trying to make sense of the world in that way. And I went to university, got exposed to postmodernism. I write a lot about that in my book. And eventually the penny really dropped for me when I did a teaching diploma in 2011, and it really showed me how public institutions are not just lagging behind and struggling to solve social problems. By the time I did that teaching diploma, I considered that one motivation I would have to have if I was going to become a teacher would be that there would be no literacy gap under my watch or in my classroom. So I expected to be trained to help struggling readers more than anything. And I really felt that I wasn't, but I also felt that the training was so poor that had there not been any pre-existing issues in the education system, it might actually create them. I saw that social institutions can be part of the cause of social problems. And it led me to become an activist, which then led me into what I call the liberal left. That was 2011. So that was, you know, meeting people who were involved in the Occupy movement, who were involved in social enterprise. And shortly after that, I met my ex-boyfriend who introduced me to radical feminism. So he is from Vanuatu, and his mother and father were instrumental in the independence movement in Vanuatu. And his mother exposed that independence movement for being patriarchal and sexist and hypocritical, because they were fighting for freedom, not only in Vanuatu, but in other regions as well, supporting other freedom movements like the one in West Papua. But they were still oppressing the women in their own country. She spoke about that and received a lot of intense backlash. But he picked up that torch from her and sort of passed it on to me. I started reading feminist literature voraciously. And that was 2013. So 2014 was a really big year for the trans movement. This is a very long answer to your question, by the way.
No, honestly, continue, because it's providing a tremendous amount of context.
Yeah. So 2014 was, as I say, a very big year for the trans movement. It was the year that Pride parades kicked off again, with all of that state backing and corporate funding, but still kind of presenting itself as some kind of anti-establishment, you know, radical protest march. I mean, it has that image quite a lot, even though it must be the opposite of that. All the big banks have been funding it. And also there was a massive upsurge of television coverage of relating to transgenderism in that year. So by now we're really used to seeing kind of heart-rending stories about people who adopt this opposite sex identity or non-binary or trans identity, and all they need is for the rest of society to accept this identity or for them to be happy and comfortable and no longer suffering. So that 2014, that really spiked. People hardly remember now, I think, that before 2014, this was kind of a fringe issue. And I started blogging about it in 2015 in New Zealand, and there was no one else discussing it at the time. So what I encountered and experienced, just discovered, was something like what I would call like a bloodlust among trans activists who seemed to be really eager, almost probably to imitate, you know, what was going on in other places like the States, where so-called TERFs, trans exclusionary radical feminists, it's a really clunky acronym, they were all being exposed left, right, and center. And there was something about finding these women whose crime really is just, you know, acknowledging that reproductive biology is real. But yeah, exposing these women and singling them out and punishing them kind of is something that a lot of liberal leftists did in order to demonstrate their allegiance to the group, I suppose. And tried to show that they support the underdog, who is, you know, these men essentially who identify as women. And there was just so much enthusiasm. One thing I write about in my book is how 2016 was the year that Pokemon Go was really popular, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And people were walking around the cities looking at their phones looking for Pokemon. And I felt like a Pokemon. Like, I felt like they spotted me, and I just saw these people converged. And so there was a pact that was started actually by the community liaison at New Zealand Prostitutes Collective, saying that I shouldn't have speaking opportunities, study opportunities, or financial support. And it was signed by over 100 people. And eventually my workplace was lobbied. My boss was told that I was a bigot and dangerous, and he kind of treated me like a hot potato. Then I started getting banned from all kinds of things. I got banned from the Wellington Zine Fest. I got banned by Phantom Bill stickers when I did a poster campaign the year that we were celebrating the anniversary of suffrage, women's suffrage. And I chose quotes from different suffragists where they specifically referred to the female sex. And I had a tagline that said, "Suffragists fought for the female sex, stop rewriting history," because this is a project that's been going on where a lot of trans activists are kind of rewriting history and saying, oh, but you know, Joan of Arc was a man or trans or, you know, and like the suffragists, either they were transphobes or they supported, you know, trans or whatever, there was this rewriting occurring. And also just the general point that women's empowerment and the necessity of women having a political voice and the reason why we have a minister for women in government is for the female sex. And, yeah, so that poster campaign got shut down and I got banned by Phantom Bill stickers. I had articles deleted from Scoop News post-publication. And the Media Council, I complained about censorship. They said there were no grounds to proceed, even though, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the removal of my articles was just the definition of censorship. I don't know how else you would describe it. I got, you know, there's a cafe in Paikakariki that wouldn't serve me. Like, just so many things, so many examples and experiences of just doors closing. And yeah. So
that was all around 2016, is that right?
2016 is when I really started feeling the heat and losing friends and a lot of online harassment. I nearly took several people to court until I changed my mind, but I filled a ring binder. I worked with a lawyer. I filled a ring binder full of examples of online harassment, mainly fueled by a few individuals. And yeah, so 2016 was really the height of that. Some of those examples of backlash, we'll say, all the way up to, say, 2018.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say, that period of time, because I know for me, I became aware of what was going on in the cultural space in 2016. And the first case of what I call shit on my shoe was in 2018. So, and it was definitely, especially in the online space, incredibly, incredibly nasty and vociferous. And the efforts that people went to discredit you were really quite extreme. You're not alone, Renee. I have a folder too, so trust me. When I read that in your book, that really resonated with me, because that sort of cancellation experience, you almost feel like you're being hunted. Now, for me, one of the things that I found really disturbing is that the people that were doing this to me, who were predominantly women, for you, was it predominantly women as well? And did you look at this and think, hold on a minute here? How can you be taking this position, because your position is inherently anti-women and you're women?
I actually don't know. I don't know if the people who, say, targeted me or simply censored my work or banned me were predominantly women. I don't think so. For instance, the Phantom Bill stickers, Scoop, that was men. And the main thing they had in common was that they were members of what I would call the liberal left or the liberalized left. But yeah, no, I don't think that there was a predominance of women. But I mean, I do know that, you know, women are conditioned to promote the interests of men, and that's one of the conditions of advancing in politics, is that you accept men's politics because that's what we live with. We can go in that more detail later, because some people don't think that that's sort of old school feminism and out of date, and what is patriarchy? You know, that's an old fashioned term that doesn't apply anymore. I can explain very clearly what it is later if you like. But yeah, so that's no wonder, really. I mean, women in politics are expected to promote men's interests. So I did experience that for sure.
So let's look at the liberal left first, because as you termed it, give us a brief description of what your definition of the liberal left is.
Okay, I can try. I'm not very good at brief descriptions.
It's fine. You describe away, Renee. Just describe away.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll start with saying that one thing. So this book that I've just written, it's a survey of the political landscape, but it's prompted by everything I learned engaging in this topic of transgenderism. So as I said, I had the social conscience, and then I came upon this issue of transgenderism, and I did this like slow double take, you know, like, hang on a minute. It really gave me pause, because I think prior to that, I must have assumed that politics was essentially an argument about values. You know, so you've got conservatives who promote family values and liberals who promote freedom and individual freedom, especially, and the left who promotes workers' rights or, you know, the underdog. And I must have taken that for granted. When you really look at the issue of transgenderism, you realize that it just doesn't allow you to continue seeing political landscape in that way. It doesn't work. So what it really taught me was that politics is based upon identification and not at all on values. Values provide the rhetoric. So, for example, the conservative tradition, which is really like the sun in the solar system of politics, is conservatism. And that's kind of premised on this old school, almost feudal notion of, you know, it's the identification is with the male landowner, property owner, householder. And then in reaction to that, you have liberalism that actually started with the Protestant Reformation, rejecting the absolute rule of the Pope and appearing to be, let's say, more liberal or interested in, you know, or more humanitarian. But actually, Protestantism was like the forerunner for liberalism, and it's really about the interests of male entrepreneurs, men who want more freedom in the market and who don't want the constraints of conservative rule. But, you know, for example, Martin Luther, who kicked off the Protestant Reformation, supported the witch craze. So that misogyny persists through the liberal tradition. And, you know, the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence, Abigail Adams, who was a feminist and the wife of John Adams, one of the men who wrote the Declaration, she wrote to him saying, you know, don't forget about women. And he replied and he said, we will never repeal our masculine systems. So, you know, that was explicit part of the liberal tradition, is that we want to free things up for men, but we're not out to support women. And Howard Zinn, who wrote People's History of the United States, talks about how one of the challenges around that time, at the formation of the United States, the Declaration, and they had to, you know, kick out the British, and they needed, he talks about how liberalism was based upon a need to create an appearance of unity among people who actually had massive, significant conflicts of interests. So he writes how the liberal language of liberty and equality was inspiring to all classes, specific enough in its listing of grievances to charge people with anger against the British, but vague enough to avoid class conflict among the rebels and stirring enough to build patriotic feeling for the resistance movement against the British and the States. So liberalism is essentially a paradigm of assimilation. It assimilates. And it tries to gloss over conflicts of interest using this rhetoric about liberty and equality and freedom. That's what liberalism is. And following the establishment of liberalism, we have the rise of unions and a workers' movement and a strong political left, which saw through that rhetoric. And one of the cornerstones of the left has always been follow the money. Like, don't just listen to what, you know, people in power or political actors are saying. You have to see who they're serving. You have to look for who they're serving, what interests they're serving, what vested interests they represent. And then that's where you find the meaning behind what they actually, you know, what they find. That's when you find what they really mean when they talk about, like, freedom, which is a very vague word. So the origin of the left was, like, that kind of critical thinking, follow the money, supporting the rights of, you know, the downtrodden, but essentially still working men. But then what has happened, especially following, you know, that since the 80s and neoliberalism, is that the liberal political tradition, which is based on assimilation, has actually succeeded in assimilating the political left. And so what you have now is this giant monstrosity, which is the liberal left, which has this totally contradictory language that's supported by postmodernism, because postmodernism really encourages people to accept a lot of cognitive dissonance and inconsistency.
Well, I mean, let's face it, postmodernism is an absolute free-for-all that was made up by a whole bunch of dirty old Frenchmen.
Well, I actually think universities, part of the role that they play is to provide the language and the discourse and the rhetoric that supports the predominant and prevailing economy and the politics of the time. So you have this political left, this liberal left paradigm, which supports male entrepreneurs, also male workers, a lot of men with different interests. How do you support them all at the same time? You're going to contradict yourself. You know, if you watch liberal leftists, one moment they're anti-capitalist. The next moment they're promoting prostitution, which is like a quintessential capitalist industry. One moment they hate science deniers. They hate them because of climate change. They hate science deniers. And the next moment they're saying that science is a Western colonial construct, which is harmful to trans people. And they switch arguments depending on which man's interest they're defending in that particular moment. And it's actually postmodernism that provides the kind of academic, it legitimizes that level of contradiction by saying there are no absolute truths and you actually shouldn't have any quote-unquote meta-narratives, because that is what makes you a totalitarian, like a dictator, like the, you know, Hitler and all of that. If you have some overarching story about the world, that's the worst thing you can have. So you should just embrace contradiction. And that's what allows, you know, that's what provides the kind of underpinning these days for this political paradigm, which is teeming with contradiction. So, yeah, that's my not very brief description of what the liberal left is.
Looking at the trans debate, because, I mean, you were somebody who was well-read, you were educated, you weren't afraid of activism and voicing and protesting something that you felt passionate about. The trans debate came about in the whole gender issue in that sort of 2015, 2016. You in the book outlined how you just followed a series of critical thinking steps, as you always had, only to come up against this resistance in multiple different places, as you outlined just before. Why is the trans debate so different from any other social or political issue? It's quite unique. Why do you think the trans debate is so unique in terms of its contradiction and how people that say from the liberal left will all be in agreement, but then all of a sudden you'll have a divergence of opinions and strong opinions when it comes to all things trans?
That's a good question. Well, one answer to that question is that the patriarchal system that we live in makes kind of a false distinction between the public sphere and the private sphere. And that can be difficult for people to accept when they hear it for the first time, because it sounds like I think no one should have any privacy, which isn't the point. But if you look at many Indigenous cultures who might live more communally, raise children communally, have more of a be more interconnected with the natural environment around them. They don't have this very sharp divide between what is considered domestic and private and what is considered to be public. And the raising of children is a good example. When that's socialized, it's an indicator of a radically different kind of society than the one that we live in. And so one result of that and of women being basically relegated to the private sphere is that anything that relates to women or children or sexuality is considered to be private and not public. We shouldn't discuss that as a political issue. That's one thing that feminists have always problematized and said, no, you know, women's issues. And that was actually the basis, the reason for the suffrage movement. Women didn't just want the vote because they wanted something that men had, like children. You know, if he gets a lolly, I get a lolly. It wasn't like that. Women feminists were looking around and seeing this, the state of women's lives and what it was to be a mother and not being able to divorce and all of these things, and they felt that having the vote would give them a political voice, would actually allow women to move out of just relegation to the private sphere and into the public sphere. So this is this disconnect. And at the same time as we have this disconnect, this divide between the private and the public, which, by the way, the entertainment industries, you know, give the lie to, because in politics, all those things, women and sex and dating, all that stuff is not relevant. It's private. But when you go to the movies or turn on the radio, we're like obsessed. You know, it's clear that our so-called private lives are actually very patterned and actually very like shared and social, because we're all crying over the same movies and storylines and songs. And so this is a part of life that we also share. And alongside that, sexuality is really foundational. It's how we came to be in the world. We are here because of an act of intercourse. And life itself persists and sustains itself through creation and procreation and reproduction. And all of us live our lives touched by this. And I write in my book about how, while the concept of sex is, you know, if you looked at the dictionary, it's you know, it's about anatomical parts and intercourse and breeding, but you know, for human beings, sexuality and attraction and longing and things like that are about who you are and who you want to be and the kind of world that you want to live in. So, interestingly, George Orwell, in the book 1984, which is often cited these days for good reason, he has this line where he says, "How could the fear, the hatred, and the lunatic credulity which the party needed in its members be kept at the right pitch except by bottling down some powerful force? The sex impulse was dangerous to the party, and the party turned it to account." So that line as well from Orwell demonstrates that while we might see sexuality as something private and not public and not relevant to politics, it absolutely is. The fact that the patriarchal system that we live in really does control and channel through pornography as well, our sexuality is political, and we've been denying that for so long that now we have this. It's, I guess it's kind of like that Freudian idea of the return of the repressed. Like, we haven't addressed it, we haven't discussed it, and now we have this issue where centuries of, you know, rape culture, which causes dissociation from the body, that's like a, you know, psychological mechanism that kicks in, it's like a self-preserving mechanism that kicks in from trauma. You know, rampant porn industry. You just did an interview recently with Heidi Olsen that talking about how this industry is now so widespread that it's leading to this upsurge of child-on-child sex abuse. This situation that we're in is leading people to become so dissociated from their bodies that it's not just a few people who are claiming that they are the opposite sex and can claim that because they're dissociated enough. That's now become an idea that has gone mainstream because we are so disconnected from what sexuality really is.
Well,
and just to wrap up, I'm good at long answers, but just to wrap up, it is a political issue. Sexuality is it's been a political issue for a long time. Feminists have tried to raise it as a political issue for a long time, but you know, in denying that for such a long time, we now have this trans ideology.
It's interesting that what you were saying in that answer, though, around the disconnection, particularly with our bodies. And I look at the element of social contagion in the trans debate, because I see it in two quite groups. In the latter, more recent arrival of the social contagion with young girls especially, and the fact that young girls and prepubescent and pubescent girls have been conditioned and groomed around the absolute natural and beautiful normality of coming into our own maturity and sexuality, it's almost like that is not allowed anymore. Like it's foreign or weird. Or in these young women, I mean, you're seeing this huge shift to these young women who are wanting to masculinize themselves because the whole thought of just simple puberty is so terrifying for them, and they're really struggling to actually embrace their own womanhood. And I find that really sad, really sad for our young women. I mean, what do you sort of think for those young women out there who are struggling with actually just being comfortable with who they are as young women?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it brings me back to what we were just talking about, and you know, how the fact that this ideology has been able to take hold so easily is a result of the fact that we've had a problem for a much longer time that we haven't addressed. So like when I was at school, I finished high school in 2001. So that's, you know, long before we had this, you know, trans trend. I think, you know, there were quote unquote transsexuals, nothing even close to this. I mean, we didn't even have the internet. Oh, no, we did internet 1996, but we weren't looking at it on our phones. The boys at my school were watching pornography on VHS tapes. And I knew that because they were talking to me about what they'd seen, and they were asking me if I wanted to do this or that later, like, you know, just to make me squirm. Like, that was something I experienced at school in the late 90s. And it made me profoundly uncomfortable, just profoundly uncomfortable. It doesn't hold a candle to what girls are having to deal with these days. The social contagion aspect of transgenderism, I don't think it's just like someone at school adopts this identity and then other kids think, oh, that's cool, I'll do it too. They're already suffering. There's already a problem there with regards to how we in the adult world haven't been dealing with, haven't been looking at the depth of what it means to be human and what it means, what sexuality is. We've been allowing this porn culture to continue and to continue. Young kids are growing up in that environment. And, you know, when I first started writing about transgenderism, I learned, and I don't know if this has changed, but when I first started writing about it in 2015, there was a pattern. There were three main groups of people who were being transed. And the first group was young boys who, you know, might like scuffing around the house in their mum's high heels, or, you know, trying on things from their mum's wardrobe, which, being who I am, I happen to know just about every man I know did that when he was a boy, because it was just experimenting with the adult world and mum's wardrobe and dad's wardrobe, and there was no stigma on
it. Was kids being kids, basically.
Kids being kids, exactly. And then it's only when they, at some point in the playground, or maybe their, you know, their parents or whatever, start teaching them, actually, you should not dress like a girl or a woman, because that's like the worst thing that you can do. And then they learn to stop doing that. Then, you know, Gail Dines wrote in her book Pornland. So this also, I don't know when that book was published, but it's probably early 2000s. So this might be outdated too. When she published the book, the average age that boys first watched pornography was 11 years old. It might be younger by now. And around that time, girls start wanting to go into puberty blockers or have their breasts removed. It's not hard to see. A lot of girls don't want to be looked at the way that they're going to start being looked at by their peers. They're trying to escape their own bodies because there's no visible movement or group of adults or frame of reference that says, that provides them with an alternative way of looking at sexuality other than porn. So the porn looks normal. So if the porn culture is normal and I'm deeply uncomfortable, I must be wrong. I have to do something about, I just have to get out of my body. And then the third group of people who were transitioning was like adult men who were claiming to be women. Anyway, so that to me, and I use the model of Naomi Klein, that Naomi Klein talks about in her book, The Shock Doctrine. She talks about disaster capitalism and how disaster paves the way for exploitation, and also it puts people in enough of a state of shock that they will start accepting narratives about the world or about what's good for them that they wouldn't otherwise accept without that disaster. So I look at porn and rape culture as the disaster conditions that have allowed transgenderism to take hold. And I don't think that the social contagion would have been able to move the way it's moved if there weren't pre-existing disaster conditions, which, you know, have been created by rape and pornography, which have dissociated people from their bodies.
Mm. It's a really interesting perspective because, there is that whole degradation in terms of your body, your sexuality, even the family. You know, I mean, you're seeing less and less women and young men wanting to, if they meet and marry, are wanting to start families now. So all of these things are starting to sort of deteriorate. So that's a really interesting angle. And I think one that you sort of sometimes consider, like, and you do this a lot in your book, where you actually zoom out to a bigger picture from how, in societies over many generations, there have been threads historically which have laid the foundations for where we are today, which I found really fascinating. Where I want to go to now, but just looking at the time, is that I also want to talk about your own disaster story, as it were, because as you said, you 2015, 2016, things started getting sort of the speed bubbles, things were a little bit sort of weird in terms of where you were going, and you were getting these pushback and this awful sort of cancellation experience. But then you also had some negative experiences from people that you were working with who shared your ideas. So just walk me through that and coming out the other side. So how you took that experience, and you describe it beautifully in the book, how you took that experience and you basically allowed you to start living a much stronger, happier life. So do you want to walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. So I'll preface that as well by saying, at the time I started receiving the backlash that I described earlier, one of my first responses was to start gathering people together. So I did that in an online group, but it wasn't an anonymous online group. So it was made up of people I already knew who had come to me and said, you know, I share your concerns. And because it was really isolating in that period to be acknowledging that you believe in reproductive biology is real, I really wanted to bring people together to provide a place to talk about it. And they were all from New Zealand, and if they were not local to me, I made a point of going to meet these people. And by the end of 2018, there were about 50 people in this online group. The whole time that I was gathering people together, I had this dream of sisterhood, and this dream was inspired by the radical feminist literature that I'd been reading for years by that time. And a lot of it, you know, and I love this literature, like Mary Daly and Robin Morgan and Adrienne Rich and Audre Lorde. Oh my gosh. It's soul food for me. It's not just intellectual, you know, political writing. And I thought that what would happen if I brought people together was that one by one, more of us would start to speak out, and eventually we would be this like colorful, creative movement, essentially, that could then start to shift the culture at large and start to make it normal for people to have the pro-woman views that I was getting dragged through the mud over. But that's not what happened. What ended up happening when the group got big enough, obviously, they valued the numbers that they had, the safety that was provided by the group, and the anonymity that they had as well. They didn't want to let go of that. And that's completely understandable. I understand that very well, because I know what the costs are of coming out publicly. So they formed a lobby, Speak Up for Women, which initially I think right at the beginning, I'm not sure if there might have been two or three people who had put their face to that, but otherwise it was largely run by women who are retaining their anonymity. And so concordant with that, you know, they didn't want to associate with me because they wanted a clean slate. That was part of the point. So they didn't want to associate with me and then bring all of the backlash that I was already getting into the mix from the get-go. They wanted, yeah. That I think they also might have thought that they could do things differently and get treated better than I had been. And I was devastated by that, like thoroughly, thoroughly devastated by that. It was like a pivotal turning point in my life. Essentially, I had to let my dream of sisterhood like die. And I grieved it deeply, but not just because of that would have been enough, but because so many bridges for me had burned as well. And I acknowledged too that in the time I was getting that backlash, I was really pissed off, you know. And I, part of the work that I was doing, like I felt that it was my job to be a woman in her full humanity and not to just tiptoe and be nice to people who were wanting to smear and censor me and things like that, because I felt that a human response was to get angry, and I wanted to stand for women's humanity, which also meant allowing myself to be angry. So that didn't help with the bridge burning. So, like, you know, by the time it happened that I sort of lost the community that I brought together, I just felt like I just had no avenues anymore to like a sense of belonging. I felt like I was on my own. And that was huge for me. Essentially, well, I mean, I'm trying to think how I go into that briefly. Too late. But essentially, I took a spiritual turn, and that's been a big part of my life ever since. I started to really felt spoken to by a lot of, I've been reading Krishnamurti and the Tao Te Ching, which informs my book too, Out of the Fog. But the Bhagavad Gita, like just been immersing myself in sacred texts ever since then. And one thing that did for me is teach me about this phenomenon of identification, because one question that I was asking myself was, if this group of people had all the intellectual equipment, like they knew what solidarity was and what it meant, and I felt like it was a contradiction for them to kind of quote unquote leave me behind, even though it was understandable, I felt that it was intellectually inconsistent. So I was like, why did they make that decision? And it was going into the philosophy of yoga that really, really answered and resolved a lot of questions that I had ever since I started looking into transgenderism, because yogic philosophy of mind says that there are three main components of mind: ahamkara, which is identification, buddhi, which is intellect, and manas, which is like the noise mind, chattering mind. And what it says in yogic philosophy is that identification trumps intellect, essentially. Both of them are survival mechanisms. So the intellect, the pure intellect, is just discernment without judgment. So an example that I think I use in my book is, if you're chopping carrots in the kitchen, you have to discern between the knife, the carrots, and your finger. That's the survival process. And there's no judgment in that. That's just pure intellect discernment. That's buddhi. But ahamkara, identification, is also survival oriented, because we are a social species and we're especially vulnerable when we're little. And connection is something we need in order to survive. And we get the message from when we're really young that for us to be safe, somebody else has to be okay or satisfied with us first. That's identification. That's how patriarchy works. That's what feminists refer to as the male gaze. Like, if I can please him, then I'll be okay. That's the basis of transgenderism. That's the basis of politics, actually. What I talked about earlier, identifications form these major political traditions. And when I started to see that, you know, identification trumps intellect, essentially what that means is you can't reason with people over this stuff. You can't just say, let's form an organization and re-educate the world about what biological sex is, because nobody's in denial about it because they don't have the information. That's so fundamental. And that's why my work, I'm so insistent looking at things deeply and broadly, because I think that if you just look at the surface and it looks as if everyone's forgotten, you know, what biological sex is, or, you know, other things that are going on in politics, that's not it. Our minds have been distorted by this phenomenon of identification. So that means what feminism asks us to do is establish a practice of looking at whatever is going on around us and going, or whatever is being proposed within politics and going, how does this affect the women who are most in need? You continuously ask that question and you will, that's how you override your conditioned identifications, and that's how you find out really important things about how certain changes or proposals or ideologies or laws are going to affect the whole society, because, you know, women birth all of us. So when things affect women negatively, that's an indication of how the culture is going to change as well, or what the direction that we're heading in. That I've forgotten what your question was.
No, I'm going to start rounding it up, because there's a wonderful quote that you had towards the end of the book, and it says, in short, grief helped me to begin to shift from fruitlessly trying to change what is outside me to acting on what is inside me. And I thought that just summed up everything quite beautifully, and it just showed, and everything in the book too, was you would explain every different little facet, whether it be politics or cultural, every different element, and then you would have the zoom out and you would reference, and you did that so beautifully all the way along. So if anyone's been listening to this conversation and you're thinking, this is actually an angle that I've not heard before, I would really strongly recommend getting the book. Now, firstly, before we let everyone know where they can grab it, are you doing any writing at the moment, Renee, or are you taking a break? What are you up to now?
I am writing at the moment. I'm working on another manuscript. I have been for at least the last 2 years. I will need a publisher for that at some point. And it is the product of a lot of the deep diving that I've been doing, and it's an effort to reconcile feminism and spirituality, and envisage a world without rape. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. I'm very excited about it. Yeah, I want it to be just as broad and deep, but also more, more engaging. Writing on politics was heady work, and I want the next book that I write to be much more, just engage people at a different level. Yeah. So I'm really excited about that.
We'll look forward to that for sure. And if once you get a publisher for that, we'll talk about that one too. This one is called Out of the Fog on Politics, Feminism and Coming Alive. It's from SpinFX Press, and I have talked about SpinFX before, but if you just pop to them, they've actually got a great website, spinfxpress.com.au is where you find them. And yes, I do. I really enjoy it, Renee. So thank you so much for sharing the book and your time with us this morning. And we look forward to the next one coming out, hopefully in the next little bit.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to sneak something in. Can I sneak something in?
You can sneak something in.
Because you asked me about coming through the other side of things and I guess the coming alive part of my book. And I got so distracted by the first part of your question, I didn't get to that. But because this is Reality Check Radio, and I know you're right, you broadcast for a lot of people who know what cancellation is. One thing that I wanted to say that I truly believe is that cancellation is a portal out of the matrix.
I could not agree more on that.
I totally encourage anybody who experiences it to embrace it as that and go on a vision quest and then, come back into the world ready to collaborate rather than, attach yourself to groups for dear life. Allow cancellation to free you of that clinging and go on a vision quest and come back when you're ready. Yeah,
I couldn't agree with that more. I've often said to people, cancellation actually set me free.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like it at the time.
No.
But yeah, when you come out the other side, it is, because all of a sudden it's a trump card that they really can only play once.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a blessing in disguise for sure.
It is. Look, yeah. Renee, it's been an utter joy to talk to you today. This has been Renee Gerlich. The book, again, as I said, Out of the Fog, and available at SpinFX Press. Don't disappear. Marty is up here next with Counterculture, with Media Matters here on Counterculture. Renee, you go well today, and thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much, Murray.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.